and welcome back to Spinal Cast. I'm your host, David Stevens, and joining us today are Josh Basil and Kelly Simino. Josh is the founder of Spinalpedia and also a trial attorney for Jack H. Olander Associates in Washington, D.C. And Kelly is the director of law and advocacy for Spinalpedia, as well as being the owner and founder of the Spinal Cord Injury Law Firm. Josh, Kelly, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here, David.
So, you know, given the two of you in your professional background and expertise, I think, you know, our target for today's episode is not only to learn a little bit more about each of you, but then kind of dive into the financial implications of sustaining a spinal cord injury and then the legal challenges that kind of come along with that. And if that sounds all right to you guys, I think we'll just jump into questions. Is that fair?
Sounds fair. Sounds fun. Let's get to it.
Awesome. So I know that both of you have sustained spinal cord injuries yourselves, and I imagine that, you know, kind of puts you in a unique position to advocate for others who have experienced their own injuries. But if you were open to it, I'd love to hear each of your injury stories just quickly, and then perhaps how your own personal experiences kind of helped filter your work that you do today.
Kelly, you want to kick it off?
Yeah. So thanks for having us here today. It's not often that I was able to meet Josh, because he and I, both being trial lawyers on wills, you don't let those kind of people passing you by get away from you. So,
yeah.
As my spinal cord injury story was from when I was 16. I was in a car wreck, and I was in the back middle seat of an older vehicle that only had a lap belt. So when the car crashed, even though I was wearing my seatbelt, it caused me to become a paraplegic. And really that started my journey of becoming a lawyer. I saw that there was clearly something missing in the car I was in. There was other seatbelts that had the 3-point restraint. And why was it that there was a car allowed to make a design that only had the lap belt?
Yeah.
And that led me to thinking about how oftentimes companies should do the right thing, but sometimes they don't. And how do you change things for the better? And so when it came along to going to college and then law school, I knew that I wanted to, help, affect change. So my focus in law is primarily doing product liability and representing people after spinal cord injuries, because of the lived experience I had when I was 16.
That's a great story. And that, sad that you had to experience that injury, but I love the way you were able to spin that into not only a career, but a goal for yourself to kind of achieve.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, let's jump into your story real quick.
Just like Kelly, I was lived a very, very active life. As a teenager, I was loved sports, loved school, loved life. And at the age of 18, I was on a family vacation at the beach, turned my back to the ocean and waist high water, and a wave picked me up and dropped me on my head.
Oh.
And that day, I shattered my neck, became paralyzed below my shoulders, woke up in the critical unit with a ventilator in my neck, wasn't able to speak because the tube was having me be able to breathe.
Yeah.
And I remember in those early days, only being able to communicate with by blinking, once for yes and twice for no. And when I eventually did regain my voice, that's kind of, I became an advocate for life. And it's been a journey of a lot of schooling, a lot of education. Next thing I know, I graduated magna cum laude from law school without ever flipping a page with my fingers. Being paralyzed below my shoulders, and became a trial attorney, fighting for families that have been catastrophically injured by someone else's negligence. And it's been a really meaningful career choice to be able to be on that side and to be with families, because a lot of times litigation can take 2 to 5 years to litigate a case.
Yeah.
And to be on their side and help them navigate it. And I will talk more about kind of all those other elements of life after an injury and the costs and financial planning and access to benefits. But so that was one side of my journey. But the other, about 10 months after my injury, I wanted to simplify the transition to life with paralysis for other families. I felt like I had to relearn it all from scratch. And I was like, I think it can be done better. So I created Determined to Heal Foundation, which is my nonprofit, which then 2 years later created Spinalpedia.com, which now has over 32,000 videos broken down by physical functionality, allowing you to find a mentor to show you what's possible within your world. And the big idea behind Spinalpedia is making sure that 24/7 people have mentors no matter where they are, as long as they have an internet signal. They can connect, they can be a part of a community.
Yeah.
They can grow to be part of it, and kind of together we're stronger. But that's a little bit about me.
Awesome. Well, and I think, you know, I love the idea behind Spinalpedia, because I think, you know, no matter what discipline you're interested in or, you know, specific topic, there seems to be these public groups that you can, you know, really dive into. And I hate to say it, but I think a lot of people who are experiencing, you know, a injury or some happenstance, it's not always easy to find that group. It's, let alone having that group be as effective and as broad as what you're able to provide. And so that's really exciting. So you kind of mentioned it a little bit in that response, Josh, but can we dive a little more into the costs that get associated following someone's injury? You know, I don't want to say how much does it cost to have a spinal cord injury, because that, I mean, it's you know, unfathomable how much it costs just socially and personally and all that. But more financially, where do costs kind of break down?
So I have an easy answer to it. It costs a lot. The fact is, a spinal cord injury is the most expensive injury really anyone can ask for or anyone can have. Just for myself, the first 3 months of being in the critical unit and to an inpatient hospital, the bill came back at $990,000.
Wow.
And that was back in 2004. So it's become even more expensive now, cost of healthcare. But having a high-level spinal cord injury, the costs are not just during those initial days. While you're in a hospital setting, the costs continue when you come home. A high-level quadriplegic like myself can cost anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000 a year in caregiving expenses, depending on the state that you live in. And then you put on top of that the wheelchairs. Like my wheelchair cost Medicaid, my insurance, almost, I think, $50,000+.
Wow.
Just for a wheelchair to get me around. And then you need a special bed. You need a lift system to get you into bed. A lot of times you might need a ramp or an elevator to get in your homes.
Right.
And then a handicap vehicle can cost anywhere from $60,000 to $120,000.
Right.
So the price of living with a spinal cord injury, especially a quadriplegia, can add up really fast, and it's lifelong. And paraplegia, don't get me wrong, that comes with a lot of expenses as well. In the hospital, whether catheters are a huge part expense for a lot of paraplegics and quadriplegics, but I hope that answered your question a little bit, David.
Yeah. Kelly, did you have anything you wanted to add? It looked like you had an answer brewing there.
Well, you know, this is that analysis that often we're making constantly. Where you're thinking about, okay, in the first 6 months, what can that cost? And that's upwards of $500,000. In the first year, I mean, you're getting between $1 million to $2 million in that first year, depending on how long you're able to stay in rehab. A lot of us are now just fighting for every last day we can get in an inpatient rehab setting because the insurance is pulling back day by day the allowance for a paraplegic or quadriplegic following a spinal cord injury. So if you're lucky, those dollars are going to be adding up because that simply means you're getting a little more time in the rehab setting. So not all costs are necessarily bad costs because that's a very important cost, but it certainly is significant. And that's why when, you know, when I'm talking to people about spinal cord injuries, as Josh mentioned, it's the most expensive injury you can have because it's significant and it's, you know, for many people, for many of us, it's permanent. It's a lifelong
right.
expense that continues. And another part of expense is quality of life. And so quality of life equals what dollars are spent to provide for a person. For me, I'm very fortunate to have single-use catheters. I'm not having to boil and sterilize a catheter each time. Mm-hmm. That significantly impacts my quality of life because it helps reduce the amount, the susceptibility of UTIs. It allows me to just have more flexibility in my day and my travels, but at the same time, that comes with a cost.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at it, but the dollars and cents of spinal cord injury equals very expensive.
I do add one thing, David, to what Kelly said. Like, it is an investment. Like, those dollars in the early days, or really all dollars towards a spinal cord injury, is an investment in someone's life, quality of life. But like, if you look back with insurance companies back in the 1970s, a person with a spinal cord injury could stay 6+ months in inpatient rehabilitation to learn how to not only survive, but to learn how to live their life in the community again. And nowadays, you're looking at the insurance companies are trying to push people out in the first 2 to 6 weeks. And to learn everything after an injury in 2 to 6 weeks when you're still not able to move at full strength or have full mobility, like, it's just, it's crazy to me how quickly insurance companies are kicking families out of their inpatient stay. And it's, I think it's doing a huge detriment to the spinal cord population to be able to live a safest and best life once they do return home.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned insurance and that, and I think that's another question a lot of people would have is like, what, you know, of these massive expenses are, you know, large chunks or portions of it covered by insurance typically, or are there a lot of things that don't actually fall under the insurance umbrella?
Well, I'll start maybe with the private side, and Josh, if you can touch on moving over to like a Medicare, Medicaid, which many people do following it. But if you're staying on a private insurance plan, which I have since I was injured almost 24 years ago, you know, you are looking at costs every year. But you're meeting that deductible but that's why the main thing you're doing is advocating for yourself for every last day. When I'm talking to families newly injured, I'm talking like, I know today is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're not going to feel like getting up today, but please, you've only have so many days in this acute setting. Use it. You're not going to feel like it, but you've got to use it because you're going to fight for every hour of, you know, PT going forward.
Right.
And so under a private plan, you know, you are fighting. Sometimes, you know, I've had a lot of times for me, it's like with different wheelchair parts or trying to get the wheelchair that I want. I'm ultimately fighting with the insurance on what. And my doctors are fighting alongside me with the insurance on what I need and why I need it. I actually made the decision ordering my last chair to just pay out of pocket.
Wow.
I decided that it was better to get the, you know, living life in a wheelchair as many years as I have. I have 3 children. I own my own business. I'm running around all over the place. Like, my number one priority right now is staying healthy and staying active. And the only way I can do those things is if I'm functioning at the top highest level. And so I did decide to pay out of pocket, cut out all the insurance middle people, mm-hmm. the DME company, order directly from the wheelchair company to get what I needed. And it comes with benefits. Certainly it came with a cost, but it was a decision that I had to make at this point in my life just to keep going.
Yeah. Well, I personally appreciate that. I think a lot of times I'm of the understanding that with something as important and as integral to your life as like a wheelchair is, I'm more than willing to spend additional money to get it the way it needs to be. You know, I think this way with like my bed. I spent more on my bed because I'm going to sleep in it every single night. And if it improves my life, I'm going to spend more money on that. And so I think your approach was well worth it.
It's just so important to have some insurance going into a spinal cord injury, because those initial costs, private insurance really takes care of the emergency room, takes care of critical unit, the inpatient. It covers those huge bills that can make or break a family that did not have that insurance. Mm. But usually then when you do come home, especially if you're a quadriplegic and many paraplegics, you then turn to where you can get long-term care services. Your private health insurance is not going to provide that. Mm. Unless you were smart enough to take the gamble of getting long-term disability insurance, which is probably less than 0.05% of people in this country.
Yeah.
Get that, because it's so, so darn expensive to get that. Otherwise, you turn to Medicaid, which forces you to become poor, because you have to meet the asset and income limits of Medicaid. And you get into Medicaid, and that's where you turn to get your long-term care supports, where you get your caregiving, where you get other support programs that help you remain in the community. Mm. So those are some of the big insurances that you need to have. A lot of people then turn to the safety net system of Social Security, where they apply for SSI. And that's also one based on being poor to get into that. And then also SSDI, if you've had any work history. Sometimes you paid enough into the system that you can get some money back through Social Security Disability Insurance to start giving and giving you a monthly check for what you've already invested through your work. And then after 24 months of SSDI, you then automatically get enrolled in Medicare. And both Medicare becomes a great wraparound insurance. So whenever I can try to urge families to get onto SSDI so they can get onto long-term Medicare, it can make a huge difference within their quality of life and getting things paid for.
Well, I think above all else, both of your responses are proving it's a heck of a lot more complicated than I think people give it credit for. You know, I would never think about all these different avenues or, you know, situations for myself. So I think I'm thankful there are people like you out there willing to help and get people through that initial phase of like, what in the world is going on? What do I do? I don't even know how to, you know, talk to insurance. I don't know who to talk to. I don't know what number to call. I mean, just having resources like the two of you to help through that is major.
And I would say to any of those families that are listening to this that feel like they're falling through the cracks or just have questions that have gone unanswered for too long, Determined EO, my nonprofit, and Spinalpedia, we speak to hundreds of families every year. And it doesn't cost you a penny. We have the ability to do signups, to look into the calendar, to match up times, to find a time to speak. So really reach out to us. Go to spinalpedia.com, reach out and find us on Facebook, and we can start that conversation.
Yeah.
To be able to help guide you through your unique journey. And there's so many variables that come into play, whether it's the state you live in, your loved one's physical functionality, assets, the ability to have, what insurance do you have? Are you in Medicaid? Are you receiving Social Security? There's a million different variables that once you have those out in front of us, we can create a custom game plan on which directions or which options you have to move forward. Mm-hmm. And talk through options, then you get the choice of deciding which path you want to take. And that's a powerful, it's good to have choice and good to have control over what direction your future can go in.
Especially when you've just experienced something that took all your control away from you. I think it's huge to get control back.
I was just going to say, because this is something that has been, you know, very important to Josh and I, and that's like how your vision of future employment or returning to work really fits in that equation. So, you know, a lot of people are thinking like, I can't work if I want to be able to receive a certain benefit. I need to have caregiving. How do these puzzle? How can I make all these pieces fit together so I can rebuild a full life,
right?
A different life than I kind of had before, but one that still connects all those pieces together that makes me feel full and brings meaning. And I guess Josh and I can say with 100% certainty, it is possible. And I'll say, like, when I was newly injured, I didn't really want to associate as part of the disability community. It was kind of scary. I just wanted to kind of keep my eyes forward, you know, stay in my own lane, just kind of live my own life. But what I figured out was that, as you mentioned, David, this is really complicated.
Yeah.
But there's probably somebody who's been on this path before that's paved this accessible path forward, and finding people like Josh who've navigated it before, connecting with people who've done it, has truly made a lot of difference for me. And that's why Josh and I, you know, certainly spend a lot of time trying to be a connectors, just because we've had those people helping us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I love that almost mentor like, you know, kind of connection that you're able to find within the community and then use that to your advantage. But I also think it feels good for that person to be able to give you that help, you know, that it's meaningful for them to be able to assist you as well. So I think it goes both ways.
It's a beautiful thing when you can get to a family really early.
Yeah.
Like when I can start mentoring a family within the first weeks and months of their injury, it just, you can get them on a different path, a different path forward. And then to be able to be a part of their journey and watch them continue to move forward, tackling their short-term goals, their medium, their long-term goals, and be able to watch that and to be a part of it. It's really satisfying. I'm gonna tell
you. I bet.
Giving back and then being able to be a part of something where you really did change someone's life. It's a beautiful thing. And for me personally, it's addicting. I love nonprofit work. And I also see, you know, within Kelly, when Kelly gets to families early, because when it comes to pursuing litigation, there's statute of limitations, which meaning like, if you don't bring your lawsuit in a certain amount of time, you're going to lose out on your ability to hold that person that was negligent against you, to hold them accountable
mm-hmm.
for what they did or they did not do. And to be able to watch Kelly get to families early on in their journey and take care of them and to make sure that they don't fall to the grass, they have representation, they have someone that gets it, that can build out a life care plan because they know what the cost associated.
Right.
It's really amazing to be, whether you're in the nonprofit world or in the litigation world, to get to families early, you can change lives, and it's meaningful.
So Kelly, that kind of leads me to my next question about legal claims and how do you even go about proceeding with those? And, you know, if someone was injured, and, you know, Josh mentioned, you know, statute of limitations and when it has to be done, and there's times that are, you know, important. Where does someone go after an injury, and how does that all work?
Well, the number one thing a family needs to be focused on following a spinal cord injury, and the injured person themselves needs to be getting that person healthy, getting them stabilized, getting their rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of life is that there's all these other things floating around. And we don't know what we don't know until we explore it. And so what I mean by that is maybe there could be some underlying claim and through the legal system that a person needs to explore. That could be, you know, if they were injured on the job, certainly that could be pursuing their workers' compensation. So those medical bills would be paid for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anytime someone's in a vehicle, I'm saying, how did it happen? Did your seatbelt disengage? Did you flip over? You know, what was the mechanism of that car wreck? You know, okay, you had a surgery and it went, you came out paralyzed. Let's, you know, what led to that? There's so many questions floating around, and the main thing is to preserve all that you can. Certainly don't get rid of a vehicle. Make sure that things are getting, you know, you're documenting things in the medical record. You're letting doctors know any information. You're preserve anything you can. Think about what's happening in that time and write it down, because it's a very fuzzy period of time.
Mm.
And then, connect with people who can take over that burden from you, so you can return back to your focus of your rehabilitation and let people investigate. They may be going to crash sites. They may be pulling records. They may be interviewing witnesses. Those early days are critical in so many ways. But it's connecting with good people who know what they're doing, so that they can start doing that work, and you can return the focus to the person who's injured.
Right.
Because oftentimes there may be a legal component connected to an injury, and you want to explore all options. Even if you don't, you've never been a person who's even known a lawyer in your life. Well, again, in this situation, having some kind of monetary structure in place equals quality of life. And that's what, I'm talking to families about who are hesitant to go that path, is just, well, let's look at what we need, not for today, but for long-term care, long-term outcomes of improvement. And turning it over to people with legal expertise that can really dive in and look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we kind of talk about all these different ways of support, and people who can find assistance in all these different avenues, one of the things that kind of pops into my mind is something like a GoFundMe. Or, giving money to a fundraising campaign to help kind of cover costs and things. And I know when we kind of had a discussion earlier when I first met you, there were some shocking things that you said about those types of situations and how you have to be a little bit more careful than other people might think. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of elaborate on that and kind of fill in our audience.
You have to be very careful when it comes to dollars. Any dollars that are raised for your benefit that end up coming into your bank account, that are gifted to you, you name it. In order to have access to Medicaid, in order to have access to certain Social Security benefits, if you don't follow certain rules, you're going to get kicked out of those programs, or you're going to actually owe money back to the system.
Wow.
So like one of the things is people love doing GoFundMe campaigns after a person's injury. But depending on how you do it, it could end up getting you kicked out of a lot of these programs or make you ineligible for a while. So it's very important to know and to have the right discussions with the right people to set up. And what I want to say is fundraising is a very important element after somebody's injury.
Yeah.
But the question is, how do you do it, and how do you do it right? So one of my favorite ways of helping to push families to do it right is through an organization called Help Hope Live. And they do medical fundraising for the spinal cord injury community, and basically allow you as the individual that's injured to create a campaign. And then your friends and family members can contribute to it, take a tax deduction, which is great. And then those dollars can then come back to take care of all and many, many different types of medical expenses and beyond for you, which is powerful. And Kelly can probably talk a lot more about Help Hope Live and how great of an organization they are.
Yeah, I can, because it's become such a special organization to me that I even became a member of their board, because I just believe in what they do, because I was seeing so often the goodwill of people. There's really good people out there that want to really help. And it is amazing to see communities come together. And as Josh said, fundraising is such a critical aspect of just surviving after a catastrophic injury, but that those goodwill intentions can come back and have unintended consequences, where a person's fundraising ends up counting as income towards them, which which would knock them off of Social Security or Medicaid. And there's just better ways to go about it. And again, it's finding the people who have been down that path before, who have had those successes, that can show, you know, ways to fundraise, but in a way that's always protecting your interest in all forms.
And medically fundraising, any type of fundraising, is so important during the early days, because almost everyone that has been a part of your life, that cares about you, that they want to do something to help, and they don't know what they can do.
Totally.
And oftentimes raising money is an easy way of having a touch point to show that you care. And especially within the first year. So I always try to push family members, if they're going to do a fundraiser, do it sooner than later, because after the first year, it's kind of sad to say, but you, with time, your injury, your disability, certain people kind of fall off, and you don't hear from them as much. And it's just those early days, it makes it that much more important.
There's certain things that fundraising, you know, there's certain aspects of having a significant disability that unfortunately we cannot cover under any kind of umbrella or financial resource. And one of the main ones, it ends up coming to home modifications and vehicle modifications. There just are not options for your insurance to cover that. And there's really not a lot of programs out there that are helping people modify their homes so that they can live their lives or get out in the community by driving a car. And so when you're talking about these financial pieces, those are the two that I just really grind my wheels on in my brain about, like, how can we do this better? Because there are so many limited resources. So that's why fundraising, you know, may be a lifelong journey, because you will hopefully continue to have a need to get out in the community and drive, certainly.
Yeah.
And then also just being able to function and live in a home.
Well, and those are two very expensive portions of your life, let alone, you know, whether insurance is covering it or not. You know, having, like, adding furnishings to a home, or, you know, altering a kitchen setup or any of that stuff. Anyone who's tried to remodel knows how expensive that costs. And same with car, you know, modifications. It's not cheap to do that. And so I think that raises another great question, about, you know, where am I able to get, you know, the funds to take care of these things? And I think for me, it's really eye-opening to learn that, you know, these certain fundraising platforms aren't always going to, you know, I would hate to be part of something that ends up, you know, disqualifying someone from something. And in reality, all I was really trying to do was give my heart in the form of, you know, fundraising to this person. And it's scary to think that in certain circumstances, it might not always, you know, prove to be a great situation for them in the long haul. And so do you have any tricks or ideas for people who are watching this or listening to this who are thinking, like, now I'm terrified of using GoFundMe. You know, I don't want to perpetuate this issue for anybody. Is there a way that as a giver, I can assure that, you know, this money is going to be helpful and not cause them additional issue down the road? Or is it really on the person, you know, on the injured individual to have their wherewithal about how I'm going to gather this money and take it into my ownership?
Well, the injured person or the injured person's family members that are setting up the campaign, if they do it right from the beginning, it really makes everything easier going forward. But I would just recommend reach out to spinalpedia.com, do our contact us page. We'll reach back out. We'll talk through it. We can help guide you, and we can help answer those unanswered questions and make sure you get in the right direction, and you do it with confidence. So that's what I'd recommend. Go to spinalpedia.com and we can talk through it. Every state is, you know, depending on where you live, there's different rules for different programs. There's a lot of federal programs that makes it easier to have a conversation across the board. But there's lots of rules that govern everything that you do kind of from this moment on after an injury, which makes it complicated. But it's possible to move forward, and there are lots of options. It's just a matter of figuring out how to do it and how to do it right.
So as far as, you know, financial planning is concerned and kind of preparing, you know, following the injury and ensuring that you have some sort of long-term financial stability, you know, protecting assets, things of that nature, what are some of your, what's your advice for people on making sure that all of those ducks are in a row, kind of moving past that initial 6 month, you know, I guess what I would call flood of things that you need to deal with. How do you kind of start assessing those longer term goals?
I mean, I think what I would say is it's never too early to start planning. I was 16 when I was injured, and thankfully I had my parents in my life that started kind of helping guide certain things for me, so that I wasn't stuck in a situation of having to live just for today, but thinking about how I could live a long life. You know, there have been some things that's really surprised me along the way. You know, I was, when I was starting my career as an attorney, and I'm healthy, and, you know, even not withstanding, I have a spinal cord injury, but all other things aside, I'm healthy, I'm active, I work out, but I couldn't qualify for a life insurance policy. And I was like, well, that's not fair.
Yeah.
I tell my kids never to do that. That's not fair, but I don't know. That wasn't fair. And so what could I do, knowing that just because of that situation for me, and I have heard there have been some people who have found ways to do it. I just, in multiple attempts I made, I wasn't successful. So I was like, well, I need to pivot. So I think that would be my second thing. One, start early in planning. And two, be ready to pivot.
Mm-hmm.
You might kind of, the steps that people tell you after you graduate college and you're working, or maybe you're injured and you've already been working 30 years and you're like, I'm not ready to tap into retirement, or am I going to go back to work, or, you know, what can I have private insurance, but I need caregiving, and how the heck am I going to afford that? So with some planning and being flexible and pivoting, I think one thing that people with spinal cord injuries don't give themselves enough credit for is their ability to make those on-the-spot changes, to just that hard wiring of overcoming and problem solving that we're just doing every day, all day, every day, because of the way we live our lives.
Yeah.
And realizing that when we're making those financial planning steps, that we're already hardwired for making those, you know, decisions. But you've got to start thinking about it.
And the big two that I always try to push on families is, when it comes to asset building and financial planning, is one around employment. A lot of people with spinal cord injuries, I've heard horror stories of people trying to go back to work after their injury, but didn't know how to follow the rules. And the next thing you know, they owe Social Security $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 because they weren't reporting their earnings properly over the years.
Mm.
Or they worked and got kicked out of the Medicaid and lost all their caregiving. But the reality is, if you have your employment journey, there's different options on how to work and maintain employment and maintain your Medicaid within your given state. 46 out of 50 states have what's known as a Medicaid buying program for workers with disabilities, where they can pay a small premium if they're employed and buy into Medicaid and have access. There's a lot of rules within those Medicaid buying programs that you help families, that I help families navigate.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, if you're in Social Security, if you are receiving SSI, there's an incredible work incentive program called the 1619B program that you can actually work and maintain your Medicaid through the SSI program, 1619B. And the cool part about that program is the more expensive you are, the more expenses you have within Medicaid, that actually it increases the amount that you can potentially earn as income.
Mm.
So it's a weird thing that it's the more quadriplegic you are, the better, which is kind of a weird thing to say. So employment is an important piece, because Social Security and Medicaid it's just not sustainable long term. It's you're gonna always be living kind of paycheck to, or not paycheck, but just month to month on the scraps of what Social Security is giving you. It's just not enough to live in this expensive world that we live in with a spinal cord injury.
Totally.
And just the world just is getting more and more expensive every single day, the cost of living. The other area is called elder planning. And elder planning needs to be done not only for yourself with a spinal cord injury, but around your family members.
Mm.
So the key is with your family members, if they were to die and in their will, point money to you, and if they did not do it correctly through the right type of trust, which is a third party special needs trust, and that money goes to you, that kicks you out of Medicaid.
Mm.
And you lose all of your benefits. And that's a really tough factor, and I see it a lot with families. So knowing how to plan for the future so that when a family member that loves you, that wants to leave something for you, in order to do that right, you have to set that up. So I always recommend being able to contact an elder attorney locally in your state to be able to set those up and to recognize kind of what are the other questions I should be asking for that future planning. And there's a lot of other different areas and directions I talk about with families on how to do it right and what questions they need to ask within their particular state.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, in what my conversations often center around or is if there is some kind of settlement, if there's a judgment or recovery following a spinal cord injury and there's a large, you know, influx of money, like how do we get that to the person? So it's one, preserved over a long period of time, and one, it's doing it in a way that's protecting their ability to maintain government services, as Josh has talked about.
Yeah, I imagine that is also a complicated process. You know, I've heard horror stories of people who win even like lotteries and the hoops that they're jumping through, and they end up losing out on a bunch of that money. So I think that's very interesting. I kind of wanted to shift focus a little bit more to the legal side, since I know both of you are lawyers, and you know, talk about the current state of kind of laws and policies surrounding spinal cord injuries and whether or not there are any kind of positive changes down the road that are coming for, you know, beneficial changes to laws or policies for people with spinal cord injuries, and kind of what kind of progress has been made in that sense.
I can do two off the bat. So
yeah, I was about to say, I think Josh could start with a major one.
So when it comes to asset planning, there's an incredible program that the federal government passed 5 or 7 years ago called the ABLE Act. And the ABLE Act, basically what ended up happening over time was only people that had the knowledge or were wealthy enough to set up certain types of trusts were able to push money into certain accounts that wouldn't jeopardize their Medicaid eligibility. In order to create an even playing field, the ABLE Act was passed. As long as you had a significant disability before the age of 26, you could have access to this account, and it would cost you next to nothing to start. And so basically any money you made from with Social Security, SSDI, or let's say through work, employment, you could push that money into this account, and any money that grew in that account below $100,000 in the lifetime of that account, or below $100,000 at any moment, and you could put almost $18,000 in it a year right now. And not have any of that money make it so that you got kicked out of Medicaid.
Wow.
Which is a fantastic thing. But one of the cool things is, I think it's come 2026, I believe, the ABLE accounts are going to lift from 26 and under to 46 and under. So that's a huge factor.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how many families I know that were 27 years old and couldn't have access to it. I had somebody last month that had their injury at 27 years and 1 month.
Ugh.
I'm sorry, in 1 week. It was like a few days after their 27th birthday. And they were blocked from having this really important account called an ABLE account. Another thing I mentioned earlier was Medicaid buy-in programs for workers with disabilities. And what we're finding out, these programs basically have different limits that the state can create, whether and how much you can make from income. So in Maryland, it was 300% of the federal poverty level or $10,000 in assets. And if you went above that, you would get kicked out of the program. After 4 years of advocating, we were able to get the governor, the previous governor and the current governor to agree to, as of January 1, 2024, which is only 10 days ago, to lift all income limits for workers with disabilities in the state of Maryland. So now there's not a threshold on how much you can make and be able to still maintain Medicaid.
That's huge.
And what we're finding is there's a domino effect across the country, where we have states in Washington State, Rhode Island, Colorado. We're having all these states that are going to the legislature, passing bills and transforming the Medicaid buy-in laws so that workers with disabilities can work to their full potential, changing the law so they can work above age 65, changing the law so that they can get married and not get kicked out of these programs. So it's very exciting times. And if you want to change the Medicaid buy-in laws in your state, contact spinalpedia.com. Also, United Spinal Association is doing incredible work around this on a national level. So it's exciting days ahead in that respect. And then there's other bills that we can always talk about when it comes to air travel and others. There's always more barriers to be broken down.
And on my side, oftentimes what I'm doing is advocating to push to not get things put in place that could harm people with disabilities. So slightly like Josh and I, like we have that synergy when he's working to like help advance. I'm making sure that certain things aren't going to be taken away from individuals with disabilities. And so, you know, oftentimes like in what we're seeing pop up that I'm, you know, trying to fight is in cases related to the ADA, like having a notice requirement where you're required to give a business who's already had, you know, like decades at this point to make themselves accessible, not give them, make it so that you have to provide notice that they're inaccessible to then have them make them have to do something. There's other kinds of areas that we're constantly fighting, both at the state and national level. I do a lot of work trying to make sure there's no caps put in place. So where if someone's injured in a particular way, like for example, my law office is in the District of Columbia, and the legislative body of the District of Columbia right now is considering, you know, legislation that could put a cap on how much a person could get if they were injured while, there was basically at a bar while there was alcohol being served. Mm. They're trying to say, okay, this particular setting, you can only receive this much money. It's called a cap on damages. And that is happening all over the states in various scenarios. And so I'm doing a lot of work trying to make sure that there's not caps being put on damages.
Well, that's huge. Cause it's an accident whether you were influenced or not influenced. It was an accident. You know, it's a injury. It's not, it scares me that they're trying to put controls on things like that. And so thank goodness for the two of you and consistently pushing and fighting for the better of all of us. Because you never know who's going to be the next person in that situation who is going to benefit from all the hard work that you guys do. So, I really appreciate that. I think that really pretty much covers all the topics I wanted to touch on, but I did want to open up the floor if there was anything you guys wanted to add or that you felt like we didn't touch on enough, if you wanted to, you know, talk about anything else.
Just anybody that's made it to the end today, I just want to let you know you're not alone on your journey. Like, we have an incredibly beautiful spinal cord injury community. I'm a firm believer that together we're not alone, that together we're stronger. So don't be afraid to immerse yourself and ask for help, because people want to give. Like, I know for myself, for the rest of my life, I will be a mentor for others, but I will also be a mentee because I'm always learning. Every day there's more to learn from the community, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to do it alone if we're willing to invite people into our lives. So please come knocking, and you know, with Kelly, she's just She's a fearless advocate for families that need help within their legal questions and legal issues. So just reach out to Kelly, contact her, go to the Spinal Cord Injury Law Firm website, check her out. And she works with attorneys in every single state across the country. And I cannot advocate enough of how luckily any client is to be a part of having her fight on your side. And just reach out to incredible organizations like Help Hope Live, United Spinal Association, you name it. There's so many incredible organizations and people and entities across the U.S. That are doing great work. And I just, David, I can't thank you enough for having these conversations today with us. You're doing incredible work, and thank you for all that you do.
Oh, thank you. I'm just every time I do an interview like this, I'm amazed with how much I still don't know about the, you know, the SCI community and what all is going on and what's involved. You know, I've been involved with MCPF since I was, you know, an infant. So I've always been around it. I've not been as involved as I have been over the last 5 years now. But it's just, it's from the heart that I am so excited that, you know, individuals like yourselves are so passionate and so committed. And, you know, I think it means a lot to even be able to assist in getting that message out to others, and just, you know, present the two of you to the world around us, because I think more people need to know about the great work that people like you do every day.
Thank you.
Kelly, did you have anything to add? Otherwise, I think we could wrap up here.
No, thank you so much for having us on your podcast today. It's important that we all are able to connect on as a community and realize we're all on a journey. You know, when I started my law firm, I really thought I was focusing on exactly how a person became injured. But what I found was that there were many on that journey of spinal cord injury, there are many places where I could have touch points where I could help a person. Maybe it's Social Security. Maybe there was, you know, a systemic issue that's affecting our community, such as durable medical equipment companies continuing to not take care of the community they purportedly serve. And so we're on a journey together. And so I'm glad to be a part of the journey tonight.
Fantastic. Well, everybody watching at home or listening on your favorite podcast platform, thank you for joining us today. All of the details for Spinalpedia and the Spinal Cord Injury Law Firm, everything we talked about today, we'll make sure it's linked in the description so you guys can all go there and, you know, read to your heart's content. And reach out. Seriously, reach out if you think you'd find value in talking one-on-one with either of these people. I'm sure that they would be more than happy to field a phone call from you. And just once again, Josh, Kelly, thanks for joining us. Yeah, I think that's about all we got.
Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.